The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. On this week's podcast, we are looking at a bevy of next generations of the Windows operating system, of BlackBerry's development platform, and of the UK's workforce. Are the changes announced by strategists Windows 8, RIM's QNX OS, and Universities and Science Minister David Willetts' behind-the-screen scheme that will get kids coding rather than just consuming software in classrooms be enough to reverse worrying trends? Joining me to look at the figures and the future are technology editor Charles Arthur and Salesforce.com's chief scientist JP Rangaswamy. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. So, Charles, I have a question for you. This Thursday, I believe, this week, Mark Zuckerberg and the team at Facebook plan to announce that they're going to be opening up their like button options to developers to code any desire, any verb that they want into a button that can then be distributed around the web. What would you have?
Transubstantiate, because I'd sure like to see them do that with a computer.
How would that work? I can't even imagine.
I don't know, but, you know, you can imagine people's fingers hovering over the mouth. Okay, I'm going to transubstantiate this element now.
Or apparate, or any yeah. Number of made up things. JP, what's really interesting about this is while it opens this up for developers to play with and to have fun with, the potential for chaos is pretty unlimited given the unlimited nature of people's imaginations, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, whenever you've seen many communications technologies take off, my worry is that the first place they go is either gaming or pornography or both. I used to wonder what a spreadsheet or a presentation was in office terms until I realized that they were the equivalent of gaming and pornography for a class of person. So once
I'm going to look at the office in a whole new way now.
That paperclip.
Hide that spreadsheet.
So helpful.
Well, haven't you noticed that? So, the possibility that the verb used may go into flights of fancy that start sort of tamping down on our learning about it worries me. But I'm sure they've found a way of solving that.
I can't actually imagine the infrastructure that we'll be able to contain it either.
Listen, I'm just thinking about the shared Google spreadsheets and, you know, what that implies.
Yes, exactly.
That's a whole new level. Well, keep listening to the next 30 minutes of Techness from The Guardian. At last week's Build conference, Microsoft announced its new operating system, the inspirationally titled Windows 8. Perhaps more imaginatively, the announcement was heralded by a pop marketing line, Windows Reimagined, a statement most accurately reflected in the decision by the company to integrate their desktop and tablet operating systems. This could be chaos. Or it could be the cleverest thing Microsoft have done since buying the Rolling Stones' Start Me Up to launch Windows 95. Charles, what details have been released about the new Windows so far? Will it be Windows 8? Will it be snazzy bells and whistles? What will be included?
Well, it seems that the name at the moment is Windows 8, though that's not certain. It's not. They could still change the name. There is a beta which people can download, which will be valid for a year from the Microsoft developer site, and there have been lots of people trying it out. At the moment, it only seems to run on Intel. There's only an Intel version available out there. And what they're doing is they are trying to come up with a version of Windows which will work on a desktop machine, but also will work on a tablet machine. And they're trying basically to hedge their bets. Microsoft had a big problem, which was tablets seem to be pretty big. The forecast from IDC suggests that tablet sales by the end of this year will be about 65 million, which is about 15% of the number of PCs that will be sold this year. PC sales growth is slowing down. Microsoft's revenues from Windows are slowing down. And the growth in terms of PC sales is all in the Far East, really, and sort of Latin America. In the US, in North America, in Europe, it's actually going to reverse in terms of sales figures.
But aren't tablets, perhaps this is just my perception of them, but aren't tablets simply companion devices, JP? Like I would think that, you know, you'd have a machine, say, in the office or at home that would have the operating system that would live on it, you know, sort of home-based, and then you'd use the tablet for a cloud service, or, you know, you'd integrate it in that way.
Well, not the way I'm using it. I haven't used a PC for maybe a decade, and I haven't used a desktop since March in terms of earnest at work. It's been a challenge to figure out what that means, you know, not having a file system or a command line interface with a normal form. But I have religiously stuck to saying I do all my work with a tablet. You know, they say when if the sun dies, it would take you 9 minutes before you knew. And that's the way I feel about PCs, you know. They have died. It just takes time for that death to sort of work itself out.
Okay.
Post-PC is not a phrase, right? The children of today are people who are enfranchised now to do things they could never do before, like an archaeologist able to work with a device light enough to hold it one hand, no wires in sight, no moving parts. There are things happening because of what the iPad has done, which is changing how we engage with technology.
So we're going to have to put you into a cage fight with Michael Dell, who this week said, I don't see any sign of post-PC at all. There's lots of these damn things selling. Windows 8 is Microsoft trying to basically have its cake and eat it. There was the option of going for Windows Phone and running that on a tablet, but the revenues from it per license wouldn't have been as good. So what they're doing is they're saying, okay, tablets seem to be selling well as a sector. What we're going to do is do a version of Windows, so they get the license fee per Windows installation on a tablet. However, the tablet versions will only run the software that Microsoft approves through its Windows Store, and they'll have to be recompiled. Probably they'll have to be rewritten slightly because there's going to be touch
interfaces.
Recompiled only when
you're using the ARM.
Recompiled certainly for ARM. There's some suggestion that to run through the Windows Store that they'll need to be redesigned for the Metro interface because that's a touch interface. A lot of people who've been trying out the Windows beta have been saying it's really strange trying to unlock the screen, which is designed, the Metro touch screen, which is designed for a fingertip, trying to do it with a mouse. It's very hard trying to drag the icon that you have to drag to unlock.
So it sounds like there is a potential for fragmentation then, you know, as we've seen with the Android platform, but also in terms of how well it works on, I mean, could this just simply regress this operating system to the lowest common denominator and you don't really get a satisfactory experience on either device?
Well, you sort of have both because you have the option on a desktop of going back to your old Windows 7 style desktop. That's sort of still there as an app, in effect, that runs on the machine. But then you have the Metro interface, which is sort of there all the time as well, and which is only hiding when you're running the Windows. So you can see that there'll be sort of desktop PCs, which will always, in Windows 8, be like Windows 7. And yet there'll be tablets, which will be running Intel chips, Windows 7. And then there'll be ARM tablets, which will be trying to be like the iPad. And those will be really recompiled software, reimagined, and perhaps the apps for that.
And locked down.
Well, yeah, locked down to the extent that Microsoft, yes, you can't put third-party stuff onto it, though I'm sure people will try.
And indeed, apparently the next version of IE 10 that will run on the tablet version won't run plugins like Flash or Silverlight, which is Microsoft's own. This is more bad news for Adobe, isn't it?
It's pretty tough on Adobe, though they are making moves to be in the whole HTML5 space because that's what, you know, the moves by Apple and indeed by Microsoft here. You know, this is basically giving Adobe until the end of next year and saying, you know, that's about as far as Flash goes. Because after that, you're going to start seeing, you know, tablets selling in big ways, certainly in the, you know, North America and Europe.
If you look at it from a developer viewpoint, you have to go HTML5 as your base and then go device-specific where relevant for specific markets. But, you know, I can't see anybody staying within one walled garden alone when you have HTML5. You know, the Flash in that sense was solving a problem that existed for a period in time, as was Silverlight. That problem has eased.
Though it's interesting that Silverlight will still be a principal way to write for Windows Phone, although even that, over the longer term, seems to be merging. The code bases are expected to merge with the Windows code base.
It sounds like a chaotic galaxy of lots and lots of different devices. Like, I say, the fragmentation, you know, it just sounds like a bit of a tornado.
It's not fragmentation quite in the way that Android is, where you get phones that are basically just left behind in the slipstream as Android keeps moving forward. This is more trying to have one Windows to rule them all, and it's a sort of triumph of Steve Sinofsky. If he can pull this off, then it's an absolutely titanic piece of organizational triumph, coding triumph, getting all the ducks in a row triumph. You know, he's your absolute shoo-in for the next chief executive of Microsoft.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I remember the early times of OS X when Classic was brought in a very similar basis, that you had two completely different looks and feels together, an ability to boot one up if you wanted to. But very, very quickly, critical mass of all the apps was on the OS X side, which meant that only the diehards kept. Now, I think the challenge over here is...
It was the diehards and the enterprises, but yes.
Yeah, but if the same thing happens over here and there's a drag on the Windows 7-style Windows and not on the Metro side, I don't know what's going to happen. I wouldn't want to try to keep those things together.
It's difficult because you have a sort of a moment. You have inertia pulling in both directions. You have all the billion or billion and a half or 2 billion PCs that are installed running Windows 7 or earlier. And then you'll have the new ones which are trying to move away, move faster. So it's rather like having something in orbit. If you have
Apple could pull it off because Classic decayed quickly enough. If Windows...
And also it had a smaller user base, smaller user base.
If you put the two together, this is a much, much bigger bet. And, when I've seen the distinctive differences, I just haven't been able to figure that out.
Well, we look forward to either the car crash or the incredible cat herding that will be coming in the next year or so. And over on guardian.co.uk/technology, Matthew Baxter Reynolds has broken down Windows 8 from a coder's point of view. So if you're interested in finding out more, head there. Now, more bad news for BlackBerry maker RIM this week as they announced a profits collapse in their summer results. A lack of new models, the rise of the iPhone and Android, and a disappointing debut for their first attempt at a tablet, the Playbook, all contributed to the disappointing figures. Playbook sales indeed were only 200,000 last quarter after selling 500,000 on launch. Sales of phones were 1.4 million below forecasts, and income before tax fell 54% to $414 million. That's from $904 million the previous quarter. So, no cheer for RIM at the moment. Charles, what's happening with their tablet offering? Is it going to go the way of HP's touchpad?
RIM is in a difficult place because the Playbook, they're not actually sales. These are shipments. So in the first quarter, they shipped 500,000 to their various customers, such as retailers, wholesalers, carriers. And in the quarter that just ended, they were only able to persuade them to take 200,000 because these things are still clogging up warehouses. They're still stacked high on shelves. And in fact, going through the earnings call and looking at what Jim Balsillie was saying then, RIM is going to have to spend a lot of money getting these things sold. It's actually going to have to fund the discounts that the retailers are going to put on these things, which are clogging up the inventory channels. So I would expect that this coming quarter, they're going to have a pretty low number again, the sort of the 200,000 number probably, because they're just not shifting. The problem is, though, that they can't kill it off like the touchpad because the Playbook is QNX, which is their next operating system that they want their phones to be on. So they're saying, This is the software of the future that we're going to be on. So developers come and build for us. But if they killed it off in the way that HP did, then they're saying, of course, we don't really believe in it, even though this is going to be a huge drag on their bottom line for the next two quarters.
JP, how would you go about saving this situation? How would you make this their shining moment?
Am I allowed to say pray?
You are. I imagine that there's a lot of
that at the minute. The email has gone and died. Whether we like it or not, my daughter uses phrases like, his phone's dead, so you're going to have to inbox him via Facebook. Right? The use of the word email does not take place amongst the youth of today.
To inbox.
Okay, yeah. Oh. And it's over 2 years since there were more messages sent in social networks than in email. So critical mass of communications has itself shifted. Right. So BlackBerry actually have at least two problems, if not three, going for them. One is the tablet marketplace and how tight that's been in order to create new growth. Two, in the market they used to be in, email is now accessible across multiple devices and at the same time dying. Right? But there is, you know, there are sparks of light. You know, the same daughter who doesn't use mail, she would probably kill before I could take her away from BBM. So the idea of, you know, presence-enabled IM with broadcast capability, they have some things that have been built within that network that create immense loyalty and response. I think they're going to have to figure out how to position in that, because being all things to all men, the bottom line drag that Charles was talking about, they can't handle. But those calls are not going to be easy to make.
Mm. Charles, how are they going to rescue the phone situation? Are they gonna focus on BBM? Are they gonna bring out more models? Your chat with Patrick Spence from BlackBerry a couple of weeks ago talked about QNX. That clearly cannot come soon enough.
They shipped about 10 million phones in the previous course, but they actually sold, carriers actually sold about 13 million, which again shows you that there were these 3 million or so phones that were sitting around in the channel, which were unsold. And they took a big hit from that. But what they did get a lot of success with at the end of the quarter was the BlackBerry 7 phones, the ones that have just been released. So there's a lot of interest from the carriers for those and actually from customers, it seems. So there is loyalty out there. And they said that they've now reached 70 million subscribers worldwide for BlackBerry services, which includes things like BBM. So that's growing at about 5 million per quarter. They are not getting the sort of explosive growth, and their revenues and their profits have both fallen for the past two quarters. They're really in a very difficult place. Yeah, they need the new phones. Yes, they need the QNX phones, but those aren't coming until next year. So RIM has definitely got at least another two quarters, I would say, of quite painful times financially, when there's going to be calls for the heads of the management, when there's going to be calls for the playbook to be dumped because it's just not selling. The situation is almost exactly the same as what we were just talking about with Microsoft and Windows, where you're going to have an old version of the operating system and the new one, which will require recompiles. And they're going to be a lot of the sort of your big money people who are staying with the old one. And the same with BlackBerry, where, you know, 70 million subscribers around the world, they're not all suddenly going to say, I'm going to have a QNX phone today. They're simply not. And, you know, for a lot of the enterprises, they're going to say, no, we're perfectly happy with these old, you know, BB6, BB7 phones that we have. You know, we don't see any need. And so the question becomes for the developers, how quickly does that change to QNX happen among the customers? And would you not rather go and start saying, well, I'll develop for, you know, I develop for iOS, I've developed for Android, you know, maybe Nokia is going to come through with Windows Phone. And, you know, I'd say that's going to be quite a sensitive balance there in the beginning of 2012, how well are Nokia's Windows phones selling compared to RIM's QNX phones? And the timing is going to be crucial.
Well, finally, the government announced last week that they are to trial the teaching of coding at GCSE level with 100 students at four schools for a period of two terms. The UK Government Minister for Universities and Science, David Willetts, said that if it was successful, the pilot scheme would be extended to more schools around the country. This follows criticism from Google's executive chairman, Eric Schmidt, who took ministers to task for failing to teach computer science in schools. And you can hear that on a previous Tech Weekly. The links are on your MP3 player now. JP, what are the skills shortages that we're seeing coming through the education system? And how much do you think things like digital citizenship, coding, all of this should be taught in schools?
I think we've got to fundamentally change how we even view that. I'd prefer to think of it as learning rather than teaching. I think for sure we're seeing drop-offs in the number of people studying computer science. This is something the British Computer Society has been looking into for the last 4 or 5 years. Serious drops in people having any interest in numerate degrees in the first place, and more particularly in computer science. And that's having an impact on how many computer scientists we actually have available. The possibility that what Willits has recommended starts showing a whole new form of students being motivated can only come, I think, with their eyes being open to people like, say, a Jane Jacobs or a Christopher Alexander, looking at design rather than learning about coding, and learning rather than being taught, you know, being opened up to ideas that will allow them to express themselves through design the right way.
Now, students embarking on IT courses have indeed seen a decline of 57%, which is an extraordinary figure, between the years of 2005 and 2010. I've seen that when I've been thinking about women involved in technology, but I had no idea that this was across the board. Could a move like Willits' scheme save this? Could it turn it around and get kids with their fingers on keyboards and coding?
Well, done the right way, it is bound to have an impact. I mean, currently, signing up to becoming a computer scientist makes you think you're going to be downsized, right-sized, outsourced, or otherwise summarily dealt with. And the startup culture, however vibrant it may be getting in Europe, is not yet as evolved and sophisticated an ecosystem as there is on the West Coast. So there are funding implications for where the clever can be done. You know, how many sort of, you know, old streets are we going to have? How many silicon fens are we going to have? Mm-hmm. So there are many bits missing, but first and foremost, lighting up the eyes of the children and saying this is a worthwhile thing to do, I think is going to come not from teaching them coding, but from getting them to learn about design.
Well, we are going to be speaking with the Minister, David Willits, in an upcoming series of live Tech Weekly programs. We'd love for you to be there and also to hear what you'd like to ask the Minister about how the UK skills up to build a digital economy. So drop us an email at techweekly@guardian.co.uk to register your interest, or to send us questions to David Willits and how to create the British Silicon Valley, or get in touch through our Facebook page, facebook.com/techweekly. And if you're interested in sponsoring Tech Weekly, then drop us a line. The email address again is techweekly@guardian.co.uk, and we'll be in touch. J.P. Rangaswamy's illustrious career in the technology sector has spanned an impressive 3 decades. As chief scientist of Salesforce.com, a title he brought with him from his previous company, BT, J.P. looks at ways of engaging people with the company's enterprise technologies, most of which are based in the cloud. Now, J.P., you have seen countless connection technologies come and go in your career. Countless. How is the cloud any different? And what is this particular technological evolution that we're witnessing, that we're experiencing right now, similar to previous experiences that you've experienced?
I think for the first time ever, the infrastructure that computing has been based on has become standardized and fungible. Okay, that you can trade storage or CPU cycles or bandwidth. That fungibility means we're able to buy what we need rather than for our peak capacity. Okay? If you had to buy anything at home or at work based on planning at peak and having to own what you planned at peak, you have no idea what it does to the kind of investment capability you have. So more than anything else, this ability now to get connected to average consumption rather than peak means, for me as a technologist, for the first time in over 30 years, I feel that the benefits of Moore's Law and Metcalfe's Law are coming into customer hands rather than trapped by intermediaries. I mean, Charles, I mean, what's your sense in that? Does that make sense to you?
Oh, yeah. I think fungible is such a great word. Fungible means things where, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're getting it, what part of the pipeline you're getting out of it. So oil is pretty much fungible. Wheat is fungible. You know, you sort of take a whole lot of wheat off a boat and it doesn't matter whether you take it from the bottom or the top. It's all the same. And so, yeah, the idea that cloud computing is fungible computing, that it doesn't matter which processor actually where is doing the computing for you is a big change. And certainly the idea of not having to buy the biggest server that you'll ever possibly need in order to do your work. That's a key change.
So what does this mean from your experience for how people interact with business and enterprise technologies, which is what Salesforce is focused on?
Well, the first thing that we've been seeing for, you know, the best part of a decade now is that hierarchies have become morphed into networks. Okay, that changes where decisions get made in an organization. It is always more sensible for team selection or task selection to take place as close to where the domain of knowledge is to make those choices. And why I think of learning from games in terms of where firms are going is that as you democratize that capability, as the knowledge to make those calls becomes available for every single person, then you're able to get much better teams. You're able to have a much higher congruence between the task that you've selected and your ability or skill.
Now, most people think when you say games, they think often of the mechanics that are implicated in creating something that's compelling and something that moves you forward. So, you know, a standard model would be dangling a carrot in front of somebody's face and then they sort of chase after it. And then
I've already got into trouble once for calling that, you know, lipstick on a pig. if work sucks, you're not going to solve that problem by gamifying it. I think, you know, it's much more close to having the right feedback loops, okay? You make better decisions if you have feedback loops. Knowing where you are helps. Use of points or leaderboards or completion bars, these things are valuable. But that's different from saying that we're going to make extrinsic rewards. There's enough research formally to have proven that it gives you a short-term high, but tends to actually reduce participation later. It doesn't mean it doesn't have a place. Recently, there was a project to use Android phones to map out bandwidth across the country. And you had bald spots because there was no simple incentive for people to travel everywhere to do it. Mm. There, a simple extrinsic device to say, you know what, just for this weekend, let's see who can cover the maximum bald spots, might have been useful. One-off, no need to sustain it, no mastery implied, right? So there is a time and a place to do that.
But the problem is that not everybody has the same level of understanding when it comes to technological solutions. So within the workplace, you've got people who've never really used a computer before to people who have used a computer a whole heck of a lot. How do you balance this gaming idea of teamwork, of team playing?
Well, I think in the first instance, you know, what you're actually doing, which is very similar to playing a game for the first time, is you land up with some form of sandbox, an induction environment where every gamer gets to understand how the game mechanics work for that particular game, gets to understand the feedback loops, has an idea of how to discover who the other participants are, and what sort of quests or missions are available. Right? Those things translate very well into work to say, when you start working a new job, you have an induction period, you understand the values and ethics that drive the firm. Then you start saying, okay, how do I discover people who think like me or who are complements to me? And you wander around being able to make those calls. They're no longer being made hierarchically because that was the only way. Now there are better ways. You know, it's like saying we used to find out what a customer wanted by making 1,000 calls to households and then extrapolating from that using sampling techniques. Okay, now there is a better way. It's called asking the customer. Now we can have a lot more sort of recommendation type data, social network support, other people telling you. You know, if you see a comment, like, you know, we saw this in chatter within Salesforce, right? Something was put up by somebody in a post and a bunch of people commented. The third comment or the fourth comment had 20 likes, right? Now you suddenly know off the comments where the person was who was carrying the weight of the conversation. You start seeing the taste makers, the arbiters, the specialists, the experts, not because they are asserting themselves to be so, not because their title says so, but because we've got the feedback loops from the people around them who will be their customers, their trading partners, their fellow, their peers.
And what would you say is the best way to integrate this into an enterprise? Simply because I imagine that there are people who won't engage with this because they don't feel the return on their investment. Again, whether they don't have the confidence with the technologies or they don't feel that it's relevant, and or they view it as information overload. So how do you encourage people to use the systems that an organization has bought into?
Two quick observations there. One, you know, I'm a big Clay Shirky fan. It's not information overload. It's filter failure. You use social networks to solve that problem because the recommending, the plus ones, the votes, the likes, and the retweets, there are many ways of being able to surface what's important when you have an active social network that understands your personal preferences and profile. Two, many of the things that we used to have in the past within enterprises are fundamentally systems that remind me of banks in the UK in the early 80s. 85% of the space is devoted to some administrative process doing I don't know what, and all the customers are squeezed into a tiny portion of the front of the bank, sort of wet and gloomy and occasionally getting some surface. That has been the way IT has been for the last 40, 50 years. The bulk of the investment has been in back-end processes rather than things that are customer-facing. Well, the customer's having none of that. They have migrated to the social networks. Enterprises now have a choice. Are they going to engage with the customers where they are or pretend that all is well, ostrich in the sand, and that the walled gardens they used to have before with proprietary locks on what they did are going to work fine?
Well, thank you very much, JP. And you can find out more at salesforce.com and read up on more of JP's thoughts on this and others at confusedofcalcutta.com. Well, that's all for this week's podcast. You can see all the links from the program at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Thank you very much to our studio guests, JP Rangaswamy and Charles Arthur. Next week, Jemima takes a trip back in time of sorts as she finds out about the archives of the Royal Opera House and the British Library and what the BBC hopes to do with them. Join her then. I'm Alex Kratosky, and the producer this week was Scott Colley. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.